Welcome to Studio 2, Episode 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Coming up later in the hour, we will get advice on how to know when to quit a job, a hobby, a relationship, okay, from former professional poker player Annie Duke.
And then I have to tell you, it is tick season, and we have an expert who will take your questions and calls about those pesky bugs and the diseases that they carry.
And in just a few minutes, Pennsylvania House Speaker Joanna McClinton will join us. But first, we spent most of yesterday's show talking about the water situation in Philadelphia, and we got word from the city that the water is safe to drink. Crisis averted. Yay!
And of course, a hearty thank you to everyone who listened yesterday and who called in. We really appreciate your comments and your concerns. Of course, we could not get to everything, and a lot of you had follow-up topics to suggest. We're going to continue to follow this story. Do not worry. But today, Cherry, let's catch up on some other important news in our region.
Yeah, Temple University President Jason Wingard has resigned effective this Friday. That's according to a statement that went out to faculty and students following a late afternoon meeting with the board. If you recall, Wingard came aboard in August of 2021. He was the school's first African-American president. But it's been a tumultuous few weeks, or a tenure for him, I should say.
Really, yeah, the whole time, start to finish. And of course, the pandemic plays into that. Enrollments are down since 2019, down 14%. There are mounting campus safety concerns punctuated by the killing of a Temple police sergeant, Christopher Fitzgerald, in February. And of course, contributing to all of this, there was the large graduate union strike, started in late January, lasted 42 days. And amid all of that turmoil, we now have word that there will be a new president quite soon at Temple University.
Yeah, and Wingard was the university's fifth president since 2000. And now, you know, in addition to making history as the first black president, he's now the Temple University president with the shortest tenure.
Ever.
He didn't even, ever. And yep. He didn't even make it to 2 years.
And I should point out, because we can make this about Wingard,
yeah,
but there's a bigger story here about Temple, Cherry. Let's compare Temple to the other major universities in the region. Since 2000, you mentioned already five presidents at Temple, soon to be a sixth. In that same time, Penn has had three permanent presidents, Drexel two, LaSalle three, Villanova two, St. Joe's is the closest with four. So this is an unusual amount of turnover at the top of a very large and important organization in our region. And we just have to keep our eye on it because clearly there is something missing right now at
Temple. Yeah, got to mention the person who comes in second with shortest tenure, Neil Theobald, who spent about 3 years there. He also had a tumultuous exit and a surprise resignation. So we got to move on. The FDA.
Yeah, and you heard about it in the national newscast. Big news. The FDA has made the decision to allow the overdose-reversing nasal spray Narcan to be sold over the counter. This is something that a lot of harm reduction advocates had been pushing for and hoping for a long time. The regional angle on this, of course, as all of you I'm sure know, is that Philadelphia has been, unfortunately, an epicenter of the opioid crisis in this country. 1,276 overdose deaths in 2021. That's the year for which we have the most recent data. That was a 5% increase over 2020. And the hope is that by making this OTC, over-the-counter, available, more people, more bystanders will be able to reverse potential overdose deaths.
Yeah, and I want to put a note out there because Trank, you probably heard about it. It's xylazine, which is an animal sedative that's been, you know, mixed with fentanyl recently, and it's caused some overdose deaths as well as some severe injuries and amputations. Well, Narcan or naloxone is not effective if you use Trank. And so hopefully people are aware of that, but Narcan being available to those who are closest to individuals who could overdose, hopefully will save lives.
I think the point you're making is that there's limits to what this can do. So hopefully this is a positive change. It's likely not a panacea, not a silver bullet. And so we'll keep our eye on the use of Narcan moving forward. Very quickly want to mention that in New Jersey, there is a new report talking about the skyrocketing rent prices in that state. According to Zillow, rent in 2/3 of New Jersey counties has gone up anywhere from 20 to 40%. And according to the National Low Income Housing Coalition, There's only 31 affordable rental properties for every 100 people in New Jersey who need them. Again, that's according to a recent report from that advocacy group. Yeah. And that is just not enough.
Yeah. And affordable, of course, is folks who spend about a third or so on their rent. And for higher income people, they can spend more. But if you're a low income, you're spending half or more than half, that can cut into food and all sorts of things. But we're going to get to our guest for this segment.
Yeah, we want to pivot now to our special guest, our newsmaker segment today. Joining us now is Pennsylvania House Speaker Joanna McClinton, who represents the 191st District, which is parts of West Philadelphia and Delaware County. Speaker McClinton was elected in February and is the first woman to preside over the House. It is, as you probably know, a narrow majority with just one seat, and she has to work with a Republican-controlled Senate.
Hello, you're in studio too. Welcome,
Good
Joanna.
Afternoon. Thank you. Thank you, Cherry, and thank you, Avi, for having me today. So glad. Congratulations on studio too.
Thank you, and congratulations on being named House Speaker. We want to talk to you about that balance we mentioned, working across the aisle and with our new governorship, Piero. We want to dig into that and talk about how you plan to use this newfound power. Can you give us a realistic legislative goal for this session, something meaningful that you believe you can get done given the political parameters you're dealing with?
So in terms of what happened in November of 2022, Pennsylvania voters elected a Democratic governor, a Democratic majority to the House, and a Republican Senate. So they want us to work together, and it's my intention to use the good relationships I have with both Governor Shapiro and the Senate President Pro Tem, Kim Ward, another her story maker, to make sure that we move the needle forward for Pennsylvanians. Some of the things that are really important to my caucus that we've advocated for years, especially in the minority, but we hope to be able to legislate now on. First of all is our schools. We see some of the crises happening in southeastern Pennsylvania and especially right here in the city of Philadelphia as it relates to both school safety and schools being adequately funded. So that is number one on our agenda. Number two on our agenda is a long overdue raise in the minimum wage. We had a policy hearing last week where so many different folks testified about being stuck at $7.25 when every state around Pennsylvania is much higher, including West Virginia, Ohio, you know, other places with Republican controlled legislatures. It's finally time that we do something there. And then the third thing is defending democracy, making sure that Pennsylvania counties have what they need to continue to administer safe and fair elections.
Speaker McClinton, I want to get specific here. There is a lot in Governor Shapiro's first proposed budget. I want you to pick out one or two items in there that you are prepared to fight hardest for, because we know this is a negotiation.
Absolutely. And the sausage will be made over the next couple of months as we get to that June 30th budget deadline. So one of the things that stood out for me that would have a far reaching impact, especially on our largest population of seniors, is the property tax rent rebate, expanding the income limits so seniors that have just a little bit more in their pensions can finally get money returned back from the state. That will certainly help our senior citizens. That will definitely help because, of course, it gets spent in our economy. A second thing that the governor mentioned that, as I said just a little bit earlier, that is key, is making sure folks who work hard are paid a decent, respectable wage. We often heard many years in the minority that no one makes $7.25. It's like, well, then if they don't make it, let's make sure that these big companies and corporations do not have the tendency or temptation to start there. So those are two priorities that I do think we can work and fight until the finish.
Got to ask you this. Jordan Harris is now part of the Appropriations Committee he's leading the Appropriations Committee in the House. You have a powerful Senator Vincent Hughes, part of the leadership in the Appropriation Committee in the Senate. What does this mean for the state and the Democratic agenda, as well as for Philadelphia and surrounding counties?
So we have seen the great work and leadership that Senator Hughes does as Appropriations Chair, not only for Philadelphia, but across Pennsylvania. It is so exciting to see my neighboring colleague, and our districts are right adjacent. We meet together in Southwest Philly, Rep. Jordan Harris, be our majority appropriations Appropriations Chair. I listened in to their meetings yesterday as they were happening, where they are getting testimony right now from all of the different state officials, hearing what's requested through the governor's budget proposal. It means a lot, because I know one thing about Chairman Harris. He is going to reinvest critical dollars into communities that need it the most, from urban areas like where we live to rural areas who are trying to get revitalized and fight blight and be able to combat health disparities. Some of the issues we have in the city, they have in rural Pennsylvania. So I know he's going to be building the alliances necessary to get the budget up and done and really make an impact.
A member of your caucus, Mike Zabel, recently resigned amid allegations of sexual harassment and misconduct. It then subsequently came to light that caucus leadership knew about at least one harassment allegation against Zabel from 2019. I want to ask you, Speaker, did leadership act decisively enough in this case?
So let me be very clear. When the incident that you're referencing occurred, I was not the leader and not informed and not able to make any decisions. That needs to be clear to your audience, because sometimes when you use generic terms like leadership, people say, oh, well, you were the caucus chair. I ran the meeting so that we could discuss bills. I was not brought into decisions that the leader at the time would have been making. But yes, our leadership team, when we learned of more recent accusations, definitely sat down with our colleague to figure out what was the best strategy and what was the best decision for the future. And I have said it before in the media and will say it again today. I was not elected speaker to tell people to leave their jobs. State representatives have the briefest terms of most elected officials around the local localities. You know, your borough officials get 4 years on council. We have 2 years. So that means before the first year is done, you're probably figuring out reelection strategies, plans. So voters get to decide very quickly if they are not pleased with allegations about representatives' behavior and other things that may concern them. And they are the ones, in my perspective, that should determine when people should leave their office.
Well, I got to ask you and switch gears a bit and talk about social media. There is a bill that would ban TikTok on all state devices, passed unanimously in the state Senate earlier this month. Is this something you think will pass in the House? And also, looking broader, some states are putting pressure on social media companies to better protect children. Is this something your caucus is focused on at this point? And we only have about a minute and a half. I'm sorry about that.
Not a worry. So at this point, we need to figure out a little bit more information, both from constituents and stakeholders, before I can tell you what our move will be. While the bill has just been sent over, we're not currently in voting session until April 24th. And once we reconvene and the appropriations hearing wrap up, we'll be able to figure a way forward with not only that bill, but other bills that the Senate has sent us thus far.
So that was Representative Joanna McClinton, first woman speaker of the Pennsylvania House. Representative McClinton, want to thank you again for your time and welcome you back on Studio 2 anytime you like.
We really enjoy
awesome.
Having
Look
you.
Look forward to it. Thank you so much.
So coming up, we have a conversation with local world poker champion Annie Duke. She has a new book that takes a fresh look at quitting. Quitting, Cherry, might be more of a virtue than you think. And that is the argument that she makes in this book. Quitting, not just for losers, quitting potentially for visionaries. That's coming up on Studio 2 from WHYY 90.9.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Studio 2 in Philadelphia. I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. All of us have quit something in our lives. I know I have, whether it be a job, a sport, a hobby. And it's usually pretty hard to do. We end up feeling bad and embarrassed about giving up.
And if you think about it, Cherry, there are so many negative associations around quitting. Quitters are seen as weak or lazy, just like one of my favorite TV characters, George Costanza from Seinfeld, who is both the ultimate loser and the ultimate quitter.
That's it. This is it. I'm done. Through. It's over. I'm gone. Finished. Over. I will never work for you again. Look at you. You think you're an important man? Is that what you think? You are a laughingstock. You are a joke. These people are laughing at you. You're nothing. You have no brains, no ability, nothing. I quit.
A dramatic representation there. But former professional poker champ Annie Duke, well, knows when it's time to fold your cards. I almost want to sing right there. She talks about it in her new book, Quit: The Power of Knowing When to Walk Away.
And it's an interesting argument. She argues that our culture is just too obsessed with perseverance, so we end up investing a ton of time and money and effort into things that we just should have given up a long time ago. Annie Duke lives outside Philly, and I spoke with her recently about her book. We started the conversation, Cherry, by talking about her quitting story.
When I was 21, I moved to Philadelphia to go to graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania. And I was studying in their cognitive science program in the psychology department there, working toward my PhD. And I did 5 years worth of work there and loved it and was absolutely planning to become a professor. And in fact, had already secured several tenure track position job talks. But during the last year that I was in graduate school, I was struggling with a chronic illness, a stomach condition, and it became quite acute starting in about the winter of that last year that I was in school, to the point where I actually ended up landing in the hospital for a couple of weeks. Mm. I was very sick. And so I decided to take a year off. But when I took a year off from graduate school, I just found myself in need of money. So my brother actually suggested that maybe I try playing poker in the meantime until I got back onto the job market. And I started playing. I immediately started doing really well. It suited my situation really well because I didn't have a boss, so I could make my own hours depending on how I felt. And I honestly just fell in love with the game and never went back to graduate school. I ended up quitting, at least temporarily, academics, and that launched my poker career.
So you argue in this book that we're too enamored with persistence, maybe too critical of quitting, even if quitting could free us up to do something better or productive or healthier, like perhaps make a lot of money playing poker. So one thing I couldn't quite detect from the book, though, is whether you think our aversion to quitting is an inherent human trait or something that we're socialized to believe. Where do you come down on that?
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, I definitely think that the way that we're socialized amplifies the problem, particularly in America, where, you know, the idea of persisting, I think, is considered heroic. That being said, these things are universal. Right. When you look at a lot of the cognitive forces that stop us from stopping things, you know, you mentioned the sunk cost fallacy. This idea that we want to protect the resources that we've already spent on something. There's also big issues of identity. I think that you can see a lot of these things, for example, in the war in Ukraine and Russia's escalating commitment to that cause in spite of the fact that things have not been going well for them, just this refusal to withdraw. And then you can also see this, obviously, with, you know, Afghanistan and Vietnam with us. But I don't think this is particularly American. I don't think it's particularly just like the way that you're raised. I think that these biases like over-optimism and overconfidence and sunk cost and the way that ownership over things makes it hard for us to walk away from them, the way our identity gets wrapped up in what we're doing. There's so many things that where the deck is stacked against us that are cross-cultural that I think this is really built into our mindware.
Right. So phrases or lessons like, you know, quitters never win, winners never quit. You say those are amplifiers of something that's already lying within us that's maybe just part of human psychology.
Yeah, I mean, obviously there's a little bit of a chicken and the egg problem, but right. I think in this case I would just make a huge bet on the psychological and motivational forces being the egg, mm-hmm. you know, and then the chicken coming later, which
well,
would be...
Well, I think one of the things in the book that kind of drives that home is that you profile people who know better about quitting and mm-hmm. when to quit, and yet they still make poor decisions. And that would suggest to me, right, that it's very, very hard for us to overcome it, even when we can, even when we know that there are these social factors at play.
Right, exactly. I mean, I would say one of the most heartbreaking stories is Jeffrey Rubin, yeah. who was one of the giants. I mean, really one of the people who initially started studying these problems of what's called escalation of commitment. So escalation of commitment is essentially what it sounds like, that when we get bad news, we have the intuition that we're going to de-escalate our commitment, right? Like, I got bad news. I'm losing in the stock. I'm losing in a war. My job isn't going well. This relationship is not going well. All signs point to stop. Yeah. And that when we see those signals, we're going to walk away. But Jeffrey Rubin was one of the original people, along with Barry Stahl, Hal Arcs. It was a generation of scientists who said, actually, no, that's not what happens. When we get those negative signals, we actually increase our commitment to the cause. We get entrapped. He had a goal to climb the 100 highest peaks in New England, and he was on his last peak and climbing with a graduate student, and a very, very heavy fog rolled in. And his graduate student actually said, like, I don't think that we should continue. Jeffrey Rubin insisted on continuing. The graduate student actually turned around and said, I think it's too dangerous. I'm going to turn around. Jeffrey Rubin said, well, I'm going to continue. And his body was found 2 days later.
Mm. Someone whose whole life was steeped in making decisions like this still made the wrong decision ultimately in that critical moment.
Yes, exactly. And that should be really a cautionary tale for all of us, right? About how strong these forces are that can cause us to keep going in situations that just don't warrant it.
Annie, I wanted to talk about grit, because in this book, it does feel like grit and quit are set up as opposing forces. We love grit, right? We love stories of perseverance, little engine that could. Penn psychology professor Angela Duckworth is probably the person most publicly associated with grit. And this is my interpretation of her work. She has set up grit as this amazing virtue of successful people, that many, many successful people have this grit. Is she wrong, or is her work just misinterpreted?
I can say very confidently that her work is misinterpreted in this sense. The grit-quit story, and she and I very much agree on this, is that you're supposed to explore a lot of things. You're supposed to sample lots of different things. And then the things that aren't working out, you're supposed to quit and try to do that pretty quickly. And the things that are working out, you're supposed to stick to, even if they're hard.
Hmm.
So the idea is to have kind of like this barbell distribution of the things that you try, right? Where you're trying to quit the stuff that isn't working really early. And then you really want to stick to the things that are working, even if they're hard. So she has never said, just stick to things and you'll succeed, because that's absurd. Because what if the thing you're sticking to is something that isn't worthwhile?
Right.
What if you're one of those people we remember from American Idol coming on and singing horribly off key,
right,
getting the feedback from Simon Cowell that you are not going to be a professional singer, and then insisting he's wrong and continuing to pour your time into that dream as opposed to pursuing other things that maybe might be more fruitful?
So in the beginning of this talk, you mentioned that you think a lot of this is innate, that our aversion to quitting is somehow rooted in human psychology. And yet you try to give us a scaffolding in this book to fight against it. Now, it seems pretty hard, if we're all kind of hardwired to dislike quitting, to actually overcome that. So how optimistic are you that we can truly, by acknowledging this and maybe setting some criteria, overcome it?
Well, I'm quite optimistic that an individual can overcome it. Because there's a lot of science that backs up essentially two approaches. Three. So the first is just approach projects trying to reduce your sunk costs. And you can do that with any project that you approach. What's the hardest thing that I need to figure out? Let me go try to find that out first before I do anything else. And that will help you to quit. But the two more powerful things. One is just called what I call kill criteria, which is to think in advance, what are the signals that I might see that would tell me that I ought to walk away? For example, in mountain climbing, you can set a turnaround time. And they do this on Everest, right? Mm. So on summit day, wherever I am on the mountain at 1 p.m., I have to turn around because if I get to the summit past 1 p.m., I know that I'm going to be descending in darkness. Eight times as many people die on the way down as on the way up. And so what that means is that I need to abandon course. Now, if you do that in advance, you will be much more likely to follow it and you will be much more rational about your quitting. And I want to be clear, obviously, when you're climbing, you can naturally realize it's 1 p.m., but there you'll rationalize it away. You actually have to think about these things in advance. So an example would be if you're thinking about letting somebody go, exiting an employee, but you're finding yourself not, you know, sort of rationalizing away and saying, I know that they're going to get better. You can set these criteria, these benchmarks, and say, you know, in 2 months, this is what I expect to see from you in terms of your performance. If you don't achieve that, then we'll have a discussion about you exiting. And it just turns out you'll be much more rational about it. You'll get to it much more quickly. So that's a really powerful thing you can do. And the other is to find yourself a coach. Think how helpful it is as people are considering, for example, you know, a sad type of quitting like divorce, how helpful therapists are.
Yeah,
because they're an outside view and the therapists don't share your sunk costs. They don't share your identity.
They don't have your baggage.
They don't have your baggage. Yeah. So a therapist, a mentor, a good friend, and there's lots of science to back up that if you can get somebody from the outside looking in who has your best interest at heart to help you make these decisions, then you will actually get better at it. In the political sphere, I'm much less hopeful.
Yeah, I was going to say, your optimistic individuals can find ways to surmount this, maybe not societally.
Yeah, I think that would take a lot of individuals figuring that out.
Right, all at once, yeah.
All at once, yeah. So, I mean, I think that the lessons that we can take societally is a lesson actually from George Ball, who was the Undersecretary of State for Lyndon Johnson. And part of the revelations in the Pentagon Papers was George Ball being very clear, like, be careful about getting into this war. Mm. Because if you get into this war, once we start losing, and he was predicting that that's what would happen, that is what will make it very hard for us to get out. It's easier to get out of something when you're winning because you don't have any face to save, right? Like you're already doing well. And I think that we can take that lesson and say that if we can understand much better how easy it is to get entrenched and entrapped, then as a matter of public policy, we could start building in things like kill criteria, right? Like building into the endeavors that
guard
we pursue.
Guardrails, essentially, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
We are starting a new midday show here at WHYY. That's why I'm talking to you. It's a brand new endeavor. Mm-hmm. Maybe it will work. Maybe it won't work. Knowing what you know about quitting and when to pull the plug on things, how would you approach creating a new show and judging whether or not it's worth pursuing and continuing?
Yeah, well, I mean, the first thing that I always do is a monkey exercise, which is it a show that people want to listen to? And you can do that through focus groups.
Yeah.
Before you actually start to produce a show, right? And I think that that's really important, is make sure that this is something that the audience actually wants. You can do some mock shows, however you can get to that answer with less investment. And then you can say to yourself, what does success look like for this show? What's a reasonable amount of time during which we can start to see the early signs of that success? And write those things down, and then you can commit basically to do a quarterly review where you check where you are against those benchmarks that you've now set, and then you set new benchmarks on a quarterly basis. And what that stops you from doing is having to make the decision on the fly, right? When you're already kind of in it and you've already put effort and time and attention and, you know, resources, money into the endeavor, and, you know, oh, listenership is growing, maybe not as much as we want, so I just know it's around the corner before this is going to become really successful.
Yeah.
And this allows you to think about it in advance in a way that's going to make you much more rational in your decisions about whether to continue.
How much of your interest in this, and I suppose your aptitude around it, is rooted in your poker playing? Like, is that how you came to understand the power of this concept, or is it independent of your poker career?
Oh, I think it's very much integral, for the main reason that folding is such an incredibly crucial option in poker. And folding is just quitting. I'm choosing to quit the hand, right? Before I find out whether I won or lost by turning my cards face up. I'm choosing to cut my losses.
Yeah.
And what you see with poker players is that they really live and die by the idea that you're supposed to be investing your money in hands that have what's called the highest expected value, which is just the highest return on investment. That's what you're trying to do. And you're trying to find out pretty quickly how not to get kind of stuck in a hand that isn't really worth your while, because we recognize that the money that we're putting into those hands is money that we can't put into other hands in the future that might win. And so if you actually look at professional players compared to amateurs, I would say that the biggest thing that distinguishes the two groups is folding more.
Yeah.
So pros, if you just take, I mean, if you're familiar with the game of Texas Hold'em, you get dealt two cards face down at the beginning, and you have a choice right then and there whether you want to play the hand or not. And what you see from professionals is that they're folding somewhere between 75 and 80% of the time, just right off the bat, whereas amateurs are folding less than 50% of the time right off the bat.
I'm terrible at poker, but but I feel like, and this is just my sense, that within the world of high-level poker, there's no stigma around folding.
No.
And it seems like, at least in that one environment, we have taken the social aspect out of this equation, and actually people who fold are maybe more respected.
Yeah, you know what? This is so interesting. I do these interviews, and then sometimes someone says something to me, or I'm like, oh my gosh, that's so smart. Why is that not in my book? I'm so sad. And you just did that to me.
Hey,
because
all right.
There's something,
but despite being terrible at poker, I pulled it
off.
Yeah.
There's a term in poker called a hero fold. And the reason why it's called a hero fold is that the professionals will recognize that it's a situation in which it would be very, very difficult to actually fold your cards for a variety of reasons. One would be the quality of your hand maybe is pretty good. And we can recognize that it would be very easy to convince yourself that the other player's hand was not as good as yours, because you actually have a reasonable quality hand there. You have a lot of money in the pot. And when someone's able to fold correctly under those circumstances, we actually recognize it with this term, like that was a hero fold. So we're, you know, I think that professionals not only really value folding and think that it's a key skill to becoming a great player, and so we really celebrate it, but we actually have a term for those people who are able to fold under those really difficult circumstances, and we call them heroes.
Yeah. Well, Annie Duke, thanks so much for your time. You've been more than generous, and it was a really fascinating read.
Well, thank you very much. And now I'm sad that that isn't in my book.
Well, that's why we have sequels.
Yes, that is true.
Annie Duke is the author of Quit, The Power of Knowing When to Walk Away, and a former poker champion. So again, thanks so much, Annie.
Thank you.
You know, I really wish I had read her book before I had to learn the hard way when it's time to walk away. She gave me life. Loved it.
Don't quit Studio 2, by the way. Keep listening.
So coming up, we're opening the phone lines for our very last segment. You can call 1-888-477-9499. You can also email us at studio2@whyy.org. The topic is all about ticks. Could be a rough tick season. We've got experts coming up. An expert coming up.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
I love Nickel Creek, by the way. I'm looking forward to that interview. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. You're listening to Studio 2. We have unfortunately entered tick season a little bit earlier this year because winter ended up being quite mild. And with nicer weather, you might want to spend some of your time outdoors hiking, gardening, simply taking in the sun.
But Pennsylvania is the number one state in the country for cases of Lyme disease, which makes us wonder, what can we do about the increase in tick-borne diseases and how can we stay safe?
Luckily, we are joined now by Emily Struckoff, who is a vector-borne diseases specialist at Penn State Extension. Emily, first off, thanks so much for joining us here on Studio 2.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And to you, the listeners, we want to say our phone lines and our email lines are open for your questions and comments. You can call us 888-477-9499.
So, Emily, I want to start the interview by asking you, I mean, we heard the stats about Pennsylvania being number one for Lyme disease. Is there a reason for that? Could you tell us why?
Yeah, so one of the main reasons why Pennsylvania ranks so high with Lyme disease and has so many ticks, it's mostly because of the different habitats that we have here, right? Pennsylvania is a very forested state. We've got a lot of very beautiful forest, parks, all sorts of different gorgeous natural areas, which creates really good habitat for both the ticks that can cause Lyme disease and also the host that those ticks feed on.
Emily, the CDC recently reported an uptick in not just Lyme disease, but babesiosis, which is apparently another disease that ticks can spread, not one we talk about a lot. What do we need to know about that particular ailment, and do we know why we're seeing an uptick there?
Yes, so babesiosis, it's, like you said, it's another tick-borne disease. It's different than Lyme disease, but it is caused by the same tick. So it's caused by the bite of the black-legged tick. It's also called the deer tick, which is the most common tick that you find in Pennsylvania. And you're right, this report that just came out from the CDC showed that, especially throughout the northeastern United States, we've seen an increase in this disease in the past 10 years or so. The reason why we're seeing that is probably pretty similar to the reason why we're seeing increases in other tick-borne diseases.
Right.
Which is a mix of causes. One is increased awareness. People are more aware that there are different tick-borne diseases out there. Another has to do with increased people living near areas where you might be able to find ticks. So more people living near forests or living near areas where there are a lot of tick hosts. Like
human
deer.
Expansion is causing more of these interactions between nature and human beings.
Exactly. And in a lot of areas, that's due to this kind of pattern that we've seen of, you know, centuries ago, a lot of Pennsylvania, a lot of the United States experienced great deforestation, you know, with expanding agricultural areas. And in recent years, we've seen more reforestation, so bringing forests back into these areas, which is wonderful, but it also puts people in greater proximity to areas where you might find ticks.
And I want to get some tick basics, because Avi and I, admittedly, we knew very little about ticks before
we were
going to talk to you. And so I want to get some tick basics. How do they attach to their host, which would be like he or I, and how could we protect ourselves from getting infected with whatever disease the tick carries?
Yeah, great question. So ticks find their host, most ticks find their host through a behavior called questing, which is actually pretty interesting. What ticks do is ticks spend most of their lives actually not attached to a host. They spend most of their lives living on the ground in the forests. And what they'll do is when they want to find a host, when they want to attach, to take a blood meal, as we call it, they'll crawl onto a piece of grass or a shrub, any kind of small plant, and they'll wave their front legs around in the air. And these legs have sensory organs on them that can detect carbon dioxide, like you or I would be exhaling if we were walking through the woods. Ticks will use this. We'll use it to sense their host. And if a host happens to walk by, they can grab on and then just crawl around until they find a place to attach.
We have a tweet from Kim I wanted to share with you. Kim wants to know about organic and non-organic products that get recommended to the public to be used on people, not pets. And I assume Kim means for tick prevention, Lyme disease prevention. Can you tell us about some of those products and sort of their effectiveness?
Yes. So that's a great question. When it comes to using insect repellents to prevent tick bites, right? So things that you can put on your clothes, on your skin to prevent bites. We always recommend using a repellent that has been approved by the EPA. We say this because repellents that have been approved by the EPA have been tested for both safety and efficacy. So those repellents are going to be things like DEET, which is probably the most common, picaridin, also oil of lemon eucalyptus. So if you're looking for a more natural tick repellent, oil of lemon eucalyptus is an option. When it comes to other essential oil repellents and things like that, generally these have not been tested for their use as insect repellents, and we do not recommend using them simply because we do not have that safety or efficacy data behind it.
Yeah. We have an email from Erica. This is a question I also have. Near my house, we have seen many deer ticks on animals and people. How can we advocate for Lyme disease testing? And can we report deer ticks in our area to the government? Should you?
Yeah. So to answer the first part of that question, for tick testing specifically, if you have ticks that you want to get tested for different diseases, we have a really great resource here in Pennsylvania called the Tick Lab. It is based out of East Stroudsburg University, and it is a resource that is totally free for Pennsylvania residents. You can send in your ticks there, and they will identify them and test them for various different pathogens. So if you are concerned about ticks around your house and you want to have that information about what kind they are or if they're infected with anything, that's a great resource to go to.
If you just joined us, we're talking with Emily Struckoff, who is a vector-borne disease specialist at Penn State Extension. We're talking about ticks, but I got a little bit of a curveball for you, Emily, so bear with me.
All right, let's go.
A caller, Nicole from Broomall, left a question about kissing bugs. Do you know what kissing bugs are, Nicole asks. I have been bit in Chad's Ford in our area. They seem a lot like ticks. So what's up with these kissing bugs?
Yeah, so kissing bugs are another potential vector of disease. In Central South America, they can cause Chagas disease. In Pennsylvania itself, as far as I'm aware, we do not have any locally acquired cases of disease that can be caused by kissing bugs.
Why is that? Why is there a difference between what they cause in South America and here?
So the difference is going to be mostly because of the species. So kissing bugs refers to kind of broadly a whole family of insects. So a whole bunch of different species, a whole bunch of different kinds of insects. And the kinds that we have here in Pennsylvania are different than the ones that are in Central and South America. So while we have insects in Pennsylvania that are a part of the same family as kissing bugs, that might be related to kissing bugs, they are distinct and they are not known disease vectors.
So I want to go back to it because I just want to make sure everybody gets this information. So I had a tick once and, you know, got it plucked off with some tweezers and lit it with a match. Are you supposed to do that? What do you do if you find a tick on you to properly, you know, remove it and dispose of it?
Yes, so there's a lot of different ways that people recommend for removing ticks. The best way is the simplest, which is if you find a tick on yourself, remove it with either a pair of tweezers, exactly like you were talking about, or a specialty tick removal tool. So just grab the tick as close to the skin as possible and pull it out slowly, steadily, and try to get the entire tick out. So trying not to leave part of it behind in the skin.
And Slow and steady.
Should you call the doctor? Should you be worried immediately? Or
so it's up to you. If you're worried, I would always recommend saving the tick. So while you can certainly dispose of the tick as soon as you removed it, you can also save the tick in case you were to later feel sick. You have that tick and could send it off for pathogen testing. Immediately after being bit, we just recommend making sure that the side of the bite is clean, just cleaning it with warm soap and water, and then monitoring it. So paying attention if you have any suspected symptoms of any tick-borne diseases, if you notice any rashes or anything unusual. And then, of course, if you are concerned, always reach out to your doctor and learn about what the best steps are going to be for you.
All right, we've got a caller on the line. Dan is in Old City, has a question for you. Dan, welcome. What's your question for Emily?
Hey, thanks for having me on. I just wanted to know if there's anything that makes someone more likely to have a tick attached to them or more prone to that. I've never been bitten by a tick in my life, so I'm just curious.
Yeah, they're traits. They're the human traits that make some of us, I guess, more attractive to ticks.
Yeah, that's a great question. And unfortunately, I do not have a great answer to you. There's a lot of anecdotal evidence, like you were talking about, that some people just get bit by a lot of ticks and others don't. I am unfortunately one of the people who falls into the former category there, where I get bit all the time.
Really?
Yeah.
How often have you been bit?
Quite a bit. I've also worked with ticks for quite a while, so maybe my data is a bit skewed there.
There's some data bias
you're
there,
in the
yeah.
tick areas.
Possible data bias there, absolutely. But yes, to answer your question, so while there's a lot of like anecdotal stories about certain people being more attractive to ticks than others, we don't know the exact cause of that.
And before we go, real quick, Emily, we talked about weather at the beginning of this and temperature. There is the climate change is a factor here in terms of tick prevalence, right?
Yes, absolutely. Climate change absolutely affects ticks.
And it's driving more bites, and I guess it seems like expanding the range of ticks across the country, right?
Yeah, so climate change affects ticks in two main ways. One is that, like you said, it can expand the range of ticks. So ticks that we have seen that have been historically southern associated, so found more in the southern United States, are able to move farther and further north as it gets warmer. And then the other main change that we're seeing is that ticks can be active for longer.
Mm.
So while in the past, we always think of ticks being most active when it's warm out, right? From April to September, roughly. Ticks can really be active anytime the temperature is above 40 degrees Fahrenheit. So
yeah.
With climate change, with global warming, if we have those warmer days, even in the middle of winter, ticks can be more active and tick bite risk can increase.
Well, we do have to end it there. Fascinating stuff. Emily, thanks for being here on Studio 2.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Emily Struckoff is a vector-borne diseases specialist at the Penn State Extension. Of course, we want to thank you for your questions and your calls. You can give us your feedback by emailing studio2@whyy.org. Our producers today are Debbie Builder and Paige Marie Bessler. Our engineer is Diana Martinez. From WHYY, I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Thank you so much for joining us.